Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
Even with the global pandemic pulling the plug on DJs and the growing popularity of dating apps signalling the death of dancing for some, I have a feeling that clubs will be eternal.
We take a world tour stopping at some of our favourite tour stories from 2021. We're in Vienna to look at the ups and downs of one of the city's most famous amusement parks. Take a load off in one of Hong Kong's very own versions of the Pocket Park. Visit an airport that never quite got off the ground in Spain. And we finish it all with a big night out. All that and much more coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to our best of tour stories of the year. We start today's grand tour on the east coast of the United States. New York saw the opening of a brand new park in 2021, which stood rather uniquely on concrete stilts emerging out of the Hudson River. Monocle's New York correspondent, Henry Rhys Sheridan, sent us this story, taking a closer look at the forces behind this odd addition to the city's public realm.
A few years ago, on my first visit to the Whitney Museum of American Art, I gazed out of the window and took in the view of the Hudson River. A bizarre structure caught my eye. It looked like a cluster of giant concrete wine glasses shooting out of the water. Their stems were of varying length, but the tops of the wine glasses melted together to form a continuous surface. I thought it was some kind of large-scale art installation connected with the museum. But what I was actually looking at was New York's newest park under construction. The park, called Little Island, opened earlier this year. It's built on the site of a derelict pier in the Hudson River. By the standards of New York City parks, Little Island is absurdly well-appointed. It's got landscaped gardens containing hundreds of different tree, shrub, and grass varieties. It's got scenic observation posts overlooking the river. And it's got no fewer than three performance spaces, including a 687-seat amphitheatre. The design of Little Island is a collaboration between the English designer Thomas Heatherwick and the French-American landscape architect Signe Nielsen. Of the pair, Heatherwick is by far the more famous. He's already left a very visible mark on the west side of Manhattan in the form of Vessel, a 16-story tall honeycomb-like sculpture in the middle of the gleaming Hudson Yards development. Nielsen's contributions to public space in New York City have made fewer headlines, but they're much more substantial. Since 1978, she's worked on hundreds of urban projects directly, but she's also been instrumental in shaping the intellectual climate around public architecture in New York. She's contributed to books and design manuals for various city departments and served as president of the New York City Public Design Commission. Little Island fruitfully combines Heatherwick's flashiness with Nielsen's sophisticated public-mindedness. It's both eye-popping and tastefully integrated into the surrounding environment, offering an unobtrusive sense of spectacle. But when it comes to the people behind Little Island, the most important is neither Nielsen nor Heatherwick. It's Barry Diller, the media magnate and multi-billionaire who footed the project's $260 million bill. In addition to paying the upfront costs, Diller has promised that his family foundation will cover the park's maintenance for the next 20 years.
In the making, IAC and Expedia chairman Barry Diller and the benefactor of this remarkably special place.
Benefactor seems too large a
word. You have a crowd here with folks screaming out saying, thank you, Barry.
I know.
And you can hear it right now. It
embarrasses me, but
it's quite something.
But it's nice to hear.
Nothing remotely resembling Little Island could, or arguably should, be attempted without an enormous injection of private money. But it's difficult to look at the achievement of Little Island without feeling a pang at the contrast between the quality of this small, privately funded green space and the site of the parks built and maintained by the city. Many of New York's parks, especially those outside of Manhattan, are poorly maintained and lacking in basic facilities. This was the case even before the pandemic. things haven't gotten any better since the budget of the Parks Department was cut by $84 million, that's 14% of its total revenue, as part of the city's response to the pandemic. In addition to being poorly maintained, parks are also unevenly distributed across New York. Poorer and less white neighbourhoods are typically much less well-served than richer ones. According to the Trust for Public Land, the average park size is 6.4 acres in poor neighbourhoods compared with 14 acres in wealthy neighbourhoods. Little Island does nothing to alleviate this problem. Not only is it located in one of the richest neighbourhoods in the city, it is contained within a pre-existing green space, Riverside Park, which stretches for 4 miles along the Hudson River. Diller's gift is a generous one. Little Island will be enjoyed by thousands. But those looking to build parks in New York in the future, be they government officials or munificent billionaires, might do well to look beyond wealthy and already well-provisioned neighbourhoods.
My thanks there to Henry Reese Sheridan. We set off on a good old American road trip now to see one of the country's many wacky roadside attractions. Stopping home in Bemidji, Minnesota this summer, Monocle's correspondent Kimberly Bradley checked in with the iconic giant statues of the lumberjack Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox, who've been posing for tourists since 1937. Kimberly visited the statues of Paul and Babe to find out more about why they were built at all and what the American roadside attraction means today.
A giant concrete elephant in New Jersey, a monolithic pair of cowboy boots in Texas, an outside wigwam village in California, and a statue of a broad-shouldered lumberjack and his huge cerulean blue ox in northern Minnesota. Roadside attractions have been big in America since the early 20th century, when the nation's first cars and highway systems emerged and long road trips first became possible and popular. Expanses of admittedly boring landscape inspired entrepreneurs and tourist boards to erect visually outrageous things to attract both attention and customers. The Big Elephant in New Jersey houses a restaurant, and the famous concrete Cabazon Dinosaur Park in California led to a restaurant on SoCal's Interstate 10. Usually roadside attractions are about passing by, but I grew up in the shadows of one. Allegedly the country's second most photographed one after the presidential faces etched into Mount Rushmore. In my hometown of Bemidji, Minnesota, the aforementioned lumberjack, Paul Bunyan, and his bovine sidekick, Babe the Blue Ox, stand on the waterfront of Lake Bemidji. Paul is American folklore's lumberjack, a master logger so tall he could chop hundreds of trees down in one fell swoop. Babe's footprints apparently created Minnesota's 10,000 lakes. Why are they here? Since train travel arrived in Bemidji in the late 1800s and the logging industry expanded, the pine forest area had grown into a popular lake district for tourists and summer holiday types coming from nearby Minneapolis, Fargo, and Grand Forks. But the Great Depression caused a downtick in visitor numbers. To bring people back, local business people orchestrated a winter carnival. In January of 1937, they unveiled a 5.5-meter-tall cement statue of Paul, wearing a red and black plaid shirt and blue pants that were always a bit too short. 2 years later, the 3-meter-tall, 7-meter-long Babe appeared with wide horns and sturdy feet. They were the ultimate photo op and became fixtures in town and, let's be honest, in my life. I was a wee 3 years old when I was first photographed with Paul, barely reaching above his shoe. Back then, there was still a small amusement park adjacent to the statues, and local kids got half-price tickets every Friday night. In high school, we made fun of tourists, but sometimes we'd head to the lake to take our own Polaroids and analog photos, or visit our friends who worked summer jobs in the adjacent tourist center, where a small museum still features Paul's huge fingernail clippings, his flag-size underwear, his saw, and other mythological lumberjack swag. As America evolved, so did its roads, and the meaning and relevance of the highway kitsch. Not long before I left for university, a new highway was built around Bemidji. Instead of random travelers happening upon Paul and Babe as they passed through, the place became more one of pilgrimage. Likewise, many attractions on the old Route 66, or in the American Southwest have become their very own nostalgic detours. That is, if they didn't entirely disappear. Paul and Babe are now octogenarians, but they're still going strong. In the 1990s and again in the 2000s, they made cameos in the movie and TV series Fargo.
Home of Paul Bunyan, Babe the Blue Ox.
Babe the Blue Ox.
Yeah, you know, we got that big statue up there.
The amusement park is long gone, but in its place is a playground and a stand of lush pine trees that make for a better photo backdrop. In the past few winters, an ornate light show has taken place around the two statues. And in July, when I took a selfie with Paul decades after my first Polaroid, families and tourists still stopped for their pictures too, eager to road trip after months of lockdown. These days, too, the statues are no longer completely alone. There's also a sculpture of a dancing Ojibwe man nearby, and in the adjacent park, a bronze rendering of Chief Bemidji, an Ojibwe leader the lake and city were named after. This culture was, of course, here long before the loggers came. Stories are rightfully amended and expanded, but as Americans travel again, kitschy nostalgia definitely still has a place. And there's no place like home.
Kimberly Bradley there, and my thanks to her. We head over to Hong Kong now, which, despite not being known for its conventional big city parks, does have plenty of places to park your bum for a few hours. Our Hong Kong bureau chief, James Chambers, visited one of the city's many sitting out areas earlier this year to observe the daily comings and goings at these essential public spaces.
Hong Kong doesn't have many European-style parks or communal gardens where you can go and throw a frisbee or lay down on a patch of real grass. But what this city does have is hundreds of small and irregular-shaped neighbourhood spaces designated for sitting outside and watching the world go by. There are around 500 of these so-called sitting-out areas dotted across the city, and they can usually be found squeezed between two high-rise buildings or nestled under a flyover. Sitting out areas are everywhere and anywhere, and no two are the same. Calling them microparks or pocket parks would certainly make them sound modern and fashionable, but these humble urban landmarks are not new, and they're certainly not fashionable. According to a new book about them, which was published earlier this year, the concept dates back to the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, when Hong Kong was building residential towers at a fast clip to house an influx of migrants from mainland China. Such rapid urban development left over many odd and unused spaces, and the sitting-out area was born. The Chinese term for them roughly translates to rest area, but they are by no means just a pit stop in the middle of a long walk. They are destinations in their own right, and they perform a vital role as communal sitting rooms for a dense city, famously short on space. Many people in Hong Kong don't have a living room at home, let alone a garden. So the local sitting-out area is a place to read a newspaper, to keep fit, to enjoy being outdoors, to snooze, socialize, and to scroll through your smartphone. The Greg Road sitting-out area is on the end of my street in Quarry Bay. I pass by it every morning and evening on my way to and from the subway, and it's always a hive of activity from sunup to sundown. During the early morning, before it gets really hot, the sitting-out area looks more like an outdoor gym for the elderly. Seniors are either conducting their own stretching routines, beating their arms behind their back and hoisting a leg onto a wall, or they're making use of the workout equipment, doing circuits on the pull-down bars, tai chi wheels, and calf stretch stand. A metal information board calls this a fitness corner for the elderly. The more advanced in age settle for doing laps around the fitness area and children's playground, holding a walking stick in one hand and a domestic helper with the other. Workout over, they retire to the shade of the covered benches. Men get out a newspaper to study the horse racing news, while women watch the rest of the city rush past on their way to school, the supermarket, or the nearby subway station. Everyone seated has a mask on, and everyone seated is ignoring the government sign that is hanging overhead. Together we fight the virus. Please don't gather here. Also behind their heads, the double-decker buses and trams that roll along the busy King's Road are providing a regular urban soundtrack, mixed in with the intermittent beeping from a nearby pedestrian crossing and some remarkably resilient birdsong emerging from a thin row of trees. Workers come here on their lunch break for a nap, while kids take over the area after school, scrambling up and sliding down the brightly coloured playground equipment. And at all times of the day, and on every day of the week, there are games of Chinese chess going on. Greg Road has three metal chessboards, and each one is attached to a stone table with two stools. This fixed furniture has been supplemented by three padded office chairs, which have somehow become a permanent part of the outdoor furniture. While a game is going on, the next challenger waits his turn on the wheelie chair. And as the games reach an exciting climax, crowds of men, always men, gather around to watch the action. On the table, red and green backed discs with the Chinese characters of a horse, soldier and elephant etched on the top are slid around the board, while captured chess pieces are tapped nervously on the table by each opponent. The lights in the sitting out area come on at dusk, and these games can go on well into the night. There are signs prohibiting gambling, and these games do appear to be mostly for fun. Nowadays, as Hong Kong builds and develops in a slower and more considered manner, new sitting out areas are being added around the city in more salubrious locations with views and landscaping. Some old ones are also getting a modern makeover. But the vast majority of sitting out areas go on filling a gap, just like Greg Road. Unglamorous, often overlooked, and absolutely essential to the local community.
My thanks there to James Chambers. Our next stop is Vienna, a city where people still go en masse to amusement parks, the most famous of which is the Prater. To find out what effect the pandemic has had on this often gaudy form of entertainment, and to investigate what role they will play in city life in the future, Monocle's Alexei Korolyov sent us this story.
One of Vienna's enduring symbols is a giant Ferris wheel in the Prater amusement park. Once the tallest in the world, it was made famous by a scene in the classic Hollywood film The Third Man, in which the protagonist meets the mysterious criminal, Harry Lime, for the first time.
There's no proof against me. Besides you.
I should be pretty easy to get rid of.
Pretty easy?
Wouldn't be too sure.
I carry a gun. Don't think they'd look for a bullet wound at you.
For most of the past year, however, the Riesenrad, as it's called in German, has stood still.
I need it. And I think the people also need entertainment and the real thrill on your body and experience the wind, the air, the smell, the taste of the Prater and the feelings that you get in a roller coaster or something like that. I'm sure that our customers come back and be very happy here in this nice place.
Stefan Sittler-Keudel and his family own and operate several rides in the Prater.
The Prater is a little bit hard to explain because it's not a really amusement park, it's not a fun fair, it's something in between. We have the nature here, we have the Grüne Prater, we have the entertainment here, we have the restaurants, we have the old rides, the Wiener Riesenrad. I love this place so much because you have to experience a place in the world where you can have fun for the last 255 years. It's something about karma and charm in Vienna, and I love the Prater, and I know our guests also do it.
Often evolving from upper-class pleasure gardens, fairgrounds and amusement parks have been part of European culture for centuries. They have survived wars and destruction, industrialization and population growth. They have also survived rival entertainment technologies. But will they survive this pandemic?
For most of this time, it's been empty. And of course, you know, when it's empty, it doesn't have the life that it needs, the spirit.
Yes.
Did the spirit go away? Is the spirit still here?
Ich glaube schon, dass der Geist noch immer da ist, ja. Früher waren's nur.
Yes, says Claudia Riedl, administrator of the Böhmische Prater, the Big Prater's smaller cousin, in Vienna's 10th district. A former brickyard, in a normal year, the park has up to 5,000 visitors every weekend.
Ja, natürlich, die Funktion ist ist die, dass halt die, vor allem für die Kinder, ja, ein bisschen eine Unterhaltung, einen Ausgleich und einen Spaß.
Our function is to provide entertainment, particularly for children. And we hope that visitors come again and have fun, because that's what this place is for.
Dass die einen Spaß haben und ja, und wir bringen halt Spaß.
Unlike the theme parks in America, European amusement parks are not really about big business. Entry is often free of charge and most of the revenue is generated through food and drink sales. But the crucial question remains. As Vienna prepares to ease its fourth lockdown later this month, will the Viennese rush back to these gaudy colours and fantastical displays? Having been deprived of them for so long, are they interested anymore? For now, the rides in the parterre are still strangely frozen in mid-air. But Stefan Zitlerkoidl assures me it's all ready to hop, tumble and spin at a moment's notice.
I have a feeling of hope and everything is clean, everything is working and ready to open in a few minutes, if you like.
Yeah.
I can start my business in half an hour and then we are
fully operational.
Yeah, nice work.
For Monaco in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Next, we touch down in Madrid at a white elephant of an airport built in Spain at the height of the financial crisis. After airport operations ceased in 2012, the runway fell quiet. So what was next for this landing strip in limbo? Our Latin America affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott, told us more.
Out over the arid plains of Don Quixote's Castilla-La Mancha, a state-of-the-art terminal to welcome new arrivals was assembled, showing off a decades-long project to upgrade Spain's ageing infrastructure. Money for public works projects had been sloshing around for years, and a local construction magnate saw an opportunity in the sparsely populated part of Spain. The Ciudad Real International Airport, nicknamed Don Quixote, after the character in Cervantes' novel, opened in 2009. At a cost of 1.1 billion euros, the site, some 140 miles outside the capital Madrid, was set to handle the overflow of holidaymakers and short-haul journeys from the city's main airport, some 600,000 passengers a year. But the airport never took off, quite literally. For months, not a single aircraft departed from Ciudad Real. A combination of tremendous funding headaches and the much-anticipated demand that never arrived. Only national carrier Vueling attempted to operate out of it, and in its last year, barely one flight a day landed on the 4-kilometre landing strip, designed, ambitiously, to service the new Airbus 380, the world's largest passenger airline. By April 2012, less than 3 years on from the red ribbon being cut, the 28,000-square-foot airport closed. It sat totally abandoned, a monument to Spain's burst construction bubble. Luggage trolleys trussed together in the car park gathered dust. The runway's yellow lines faded, and what little demand remained was reduced to it being a drop-off point for hunting enthusiasts, keen to visit the region's renowned country estates, or as a movie set for Spanish director Pedro Almodóvar. A different sort of arrival, however, that of coronavirus, is shaking things up for this sleeping giant. The ghost airport is reinventing itself as a park for idle jets. The pivot comes as more than 8,000 planes sit at a standstill around the world, roughly 30% of the global fleet, according to aviation specialists. Fresh waves of infection have meant that any hope of a resurgence in international travel as the new year kicks off just hasn't materialised. Smaller airports, too, are facing a financial crisis of their own, with one in four European hubs struggling to fight off insolvency without state help. So they simply can't afford to offer a decent parking space. Ciudad Real, with its spacious airfield and dry, desert-like climate, got creative, positioning itself as a safe place to park your 747. The main taxiway has been converted to increase capacity. At the moment, it can accommodate about half of the almost 80 jets parked at the hub, with plans to store 300 planes through a series of renovation projects planned by the operator this year. A smart new business plan, based on grounded flights and plane maintenance. Are we ready for no takeoff?
Lucinda Elliott there, and thank you to her. Lastly today, we hit the dance floor. Back in March, a night out seemed a quite far-off possibility, so Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco took us through some of his favourite nightclub memories as he waited for the doors to open again.
It's hard to say if it's because I'm deprived of a good dance floor at the moment, but since the beginning of the pandemic, I've been daydreaming about one of the first clubs I ever went to, A Louca, in my hometown of São Paulo. From the design point of view, it would be difficult to celebrate it as a masterpiece, but from a pure fun point of view, I thought it was delightful. It was one of those clubs in São Paulo with a wonderful, eclectic crowd, where the young gay kids would mix with everyone, from goths to sex workers. They were all in there. My favorite night was on Sundays. The playlist ranged from Depeche Mode to Spice Girls to Brazilian kids TV presenter Xuxa. The cavernous club had the look of a regional haunted house, but with happier music. The floor was black concrete, and there was a space that looked similar to a boxing ring, but rather than punches being thrown, that was the place where drag queens would come to perform their late-night sketches. A Louca was made like a labyrinth, but its enormous interiors meant there was always a cozy corner to be found. It was in one of those corners that I discovered Que Fim Levou Robin by the late Mauro Borges, a Brazilian band I used to love, as well as many other excellent artists. The whole aesthetic of the club was inspired by Alice in the Wonderland, a naughtier version of it, I must add, with no regard for minimalism. From my memory, there were no air conditioners, but only hefty ventilators to help out during those hot summer nights. The club was so important to Paulistas that in the year 2000, former mayor Marta Suplicy included the club on her campaign trail. She was duly elected, of course. But in my dancing daydreams, other clubs have been featuring too. The small and intimate Trash Palace in London Soho, one of the first places I went dancing after moving to London. It too was a narrow, sweaty labyrinth, but the music and the crowd was so incredible. Or for those that need a bit more space to dance, gigantic clubs like the Astoria spring to mind. I mean, even Madonna performed there. More recently, I was taken by a different clubbing experience in Lisbon. I went dancing at a 60s-inspired Austin Powers-esque venue, which looked incredible. And while the average person in the crowd was a good 30 years older than me, they all definitely knew how to dance. The lacquered-haired ladies still have me trying to imitate some of their best moves. I could reminisce endlessly about the fun I've had over the years in clubs all over the world, but all this is to say that I believe clubs play an essential part in a city's branding. I mean, who would want to visit a city without a good dance floor? A city's night economy should never be ignored. It's the reason so many cities are employing the services of a night mayor, to make sure that what happens after dark continues to make the city a better place to be. But even with the global pandemic pulling the plug on DJs and the growing popularity of dating apps signaling the death of dancing for some, I have a feeling that clubs will be eternal. You just can't beat the power of the dance floor.
My thanks to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts for your weekly dose of urbanism every Thursday, as well as our weekly sister show, Tall Stories, premiering every Monday. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens, and David also edited the show. Oh, and one other thing. Thank you for listening all year. Your support has been amazing, and we look forward to spending more time with you in 2022. Hey, and Happy New Year. And to play you out this week, well, here's the Growlers with City Club. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.